Hello and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 3rd. Today's session number is SUK 2004-02. Today's speaker is Carla Somala. The lesson for today is Jacob, a lifetime of call. Let's listen in.
All right, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to start with, as long as we're going to be studying Torah again this morning, the rabbis have some interesting ideas about studying Torah. And when you take a look at the rabbis, nothing is ever simple. How much should one study the Torah? And for what reason should one study the Torah? Here's one citation from the Talmud. Great is the study of the Torah because it leads to action. Right. Now that's kind of an interesting, that there was an ongoing debate among the rabbis and in the Jewish community of faith. How much should one study and for what purpose? Right. And is study an end in itself, or is there something more to it? But in this case, it seems that the majority opinion comes down on the side of action. If you're studying Torah and there's no action, you better reconsider. Another rabbi says, Rabbi Hanina Ben Dosa used to say, and that's a classical way that you find citations in rabbinic literature. This is way before the days where we were concerned about plagiarism. But interestingly enough, the rabbis always cited their sources. They used to cite the name of the rabbi who used to say something. So he used to say, anyone, and I'm sorry, this is not necessarily gender fair, because everybody was a he in those days. Anyone whose deeds exceed his wisdom shall endure. Anyone whose wisdom exceeds his wisdom shall not endure. So kind of, playing with this idea and knowledge and action and how those two sorts of things should fit together. And I think that's something that Holden Village struggles with. How much do we talk about things and how much do we learn about things and how many things should we be doing? And I think that that's always a struggle to try to keep those two things in balance. All right. I'm going to be telling you a little bit this morning, before we start our biblical study proper, where I'm finding some of these sayings and kind of what role they've played in Jewish tradition. So I'm going to give you a little bit of history and a little bit of literary background this morning. But before I do that, you can kind of think of yourself. The rabbis use a lot of mnemonic devices. A lot of this material they memorized. And so you often have sayings, there are four kinds of people, or there are three kinds of blessings, or there are two kinds of laws, this, that, and the other. So this morning, there are four kinds of students. So see if you can find yourself in this package. The first, and I've updated these to modern sorts of equivalents. First of all, there's a student who is like a sponge and takes in everything. Right? Second, there's a student like a colander where everything just drains through. There's a third sort of student who's like, and this is good for Lutherans and church people in general, and being in this, Pacific Northwest, a coffee filter. A student who keeps all the dregs and lets the good stuff go. The fourth kind of student is like a sieve who keeps the good grain and lets the chaff and dust go. What kind of student are you? Right? And what kinds of student do you think the rabbis would hold up? Hint. Yeah. The best one is usually at the end, all right? So you're not going to be finding it somewhere in the middle. So those are some of the things that the rabbis talk about when they talk about study and learning and Torah. We're going to be a little bit more old-fashioned today. I'll bring PowerPoint back, but sometimes there's nothing to replace. And I was going to say a good old-fashioned blackboard, but I guess I should say whiteboard. Yeah, with markers. Exactly. I mentioned yesterday that the rabbis that we're talking about, the Jewish tradition that we're talking about, emerges at about the same time as Christianity. All right? They are siblings. So if you take a look at it in sort of this way, you've got ancient Israelite religion. And what were they centered around? One God, one temple. This, and we can say, and this kind of goes up to the first century of our era, the Common Era. And at that first century, a lot was happening. And what we today call the Middle East, but in those days the Near East, ancient Near East, a lot of changes were happening. A lot of turbulence, a lot of changing of world order. Right? So that by the time you reach 70 CE, and that basically, for those of you, this is a notation that I generally use in class, BCE and CE, before the Common Era and the Common Era, instead of BC and AD. So 70 CE, the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed for the very last time. What is there today, the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall, is the last piece of that temple. But since 70, there has been no temple. Now, what do you do in a religion that is centered around one God and one temple? All right? It wasn't sort of an extra. You need to do some radical rethinking of your religious tradition, especially when you don't have the power or the resources to rebuild that temple. So in that first common, or that first century, you have this people trying to figure out how to continue being the people of God without their temple. Now this would apply to the followers of Jesus as well. We don't know what Christianity would have looked like if the temple had remained standing. Jesus never rejected the temple in and of itself, neither did Paul. They both claimed their Jewish roots or their ancient Israelite roots. So when you have the center of a faith come down, you've got a lot of scrambling going on. So in this first century, you have emerging from all of the chaos two new faith systems. Doesn't mean that there were only two. In the first century, the rabbinic literature and Josephus, a first century historian, tells us that there were at least 24 different kinds of Jews. It's kind of like Protestantism today. All right? Everybody wanted, claimed to be a Jew, but they had a different way of living that out. All right? So very much, and I think we can relate well to that today. There are many kinds of Christians. We have different ways of living out our lives as Christians or people of faith. And so you have two different, out of the chaos, as I mentioned, two different groups emerge. You've got Christians, and you've got rabbinic Jews. Some would say these two were the winners of that, kind of all-out chaos in the first century. The rabbinic Jews sometimes trace their roots to the Pharisees, and the Christians came out of that same sort of melting pot and turbulence of that. These two, then, instead of being like a parent-child relationship, are really more like sisters. They emerged in that same boiling stew and came out. And at first, they were much closer in terms of the way they approached things and the way they approached that idea of having one God. As that century wore on and as they moved into the second century, they began to divide. And a lot of issues created that. A couple of them were over the Torah. How much of it do you follow? How much of it do you not follow? All right? And Paul has a lot to say with this. If you take a look at Galatians, he's got some interesting discussions there. The question is, the Jewish Christian leaders come to him, in order to follow Jesus, you need to follow the dietary laws and be circumcised. Those had been two parts of that ancient Israelite religion. Now, Paul was finding, as an evangelist on the road, that circumcision was not a really good, you know, invitational sort of thing. He was finding that it was limiting his, you know, the following. You know, I guess more women perhaps were interested, but you know, you go into a congregation and you say, we've got this leader, Jesus. He died, he was resurrected, he went to heaven. This is amazing news, the good news. Oh, and by the way, there's this little circumcision thing, if you could follow the usher out. Yeah, didn't go over so well. So they had to do some reconsidering if they were going to make this invitation a little bit broader. Now, not everybody was happy about that. They said, wait a second. These other Jews and other Jewish Christians said, wait a minute. Circumcision is what God told Abraham to do. It is a mark of who we are as a people of God. If you're going to give that up, you're selling out. We can't abide by that. There are some things we can possibly give up. We've already had to give up the temple, but don't mess with circumcision and dietary laws. And I can see their point. As people today, we're struggling with our identity as Americans. We're struggling in different denominations. What does it mean to be a Methodist? What does it mean to be a Catholic today or a Lutheran? In each of these groups, we're not exactly sure. Right? So that's kind of one of the things, the identity issues were emerging out of that. As these two groups, as I noted, continued, and they continued to part ways over issues like circumcision and dietary laws, so that by the first and certainly the second century of our era, they were pretty well separated, and they didn't have much to do with each other. They took different tracks. Now, in that separating of the ways, Christians and Jews tried to define themselves against each other, all right? How do you define your identity? Often, you define yourself by saying, I'm not like her, I'm not like him, I'm not like them, definitely. You know, you often do it negatively, and that's what happened. They tried to separate themselves, and sometimes for good reason. In the Roman Empire, when the Roman Emperor looked at them, he thought they're all part of the same group. Jews, Christians, what's the difference? All crazy. You know, and they said, no, 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 we are different. All right? So they kind of started that self-differentiation process. What the Jews primarily had to do, and what these early Christians had to do, was answering, are we to be people of this one God without a temple? For Christians, the good news of Jesus helped them to answer that question in one way. And this gets more theologically complicated, so I'm not going to, you know, that's a whole session in itself. But they kind of focused on this good news and what that meant for them. For the rabbinic Jews, they started to look at the Torah. And both of these groups were able to make that ancient Israelite religion portable. After that 70 AD mark, Jews and Christians could go anywhere. They could go anywhere in the world. Portable. You've got a religion that packs up easily. Before that, you couldn't pack up so easily. You needed to be attached in one way or another to that temple. But after that point, there was nothing holding you to a specific place for specific times. So in that portability, they were able to go throughout the world. That's what made it much easier to do so. Leaving behind things like circumcision was partly Paul's answer to making it more portable, Christianity more portable, as well as other sorts of things. For the Jews, they figure as long as we've got the Torah and we hold on to some key traditions, we can go anywhere. And they did. It's not as if they wanted to go anywhere. They were pretty much kicked out of Palestine, all right, and the area where the temple was. By 135 CE, they were barred from Jerusalem, all right? So in all of this, and how did they make the Torah portable? There are a group of rabbis who got together, and so legend tells us, we wish we had some notes from these meetings, we don't, who said, okay, what is essential? What's not? What's the grain here? What's the chaff? What are we going to keep? And, you know, they started reworking all of their beliefs and traditions and trying to work through them to try to figure out, okay, how do we move along with this? It was during this time period that they started talking about kind of an interesting way of viewing Torah. They claim that it goes back to Moses, but you don't see it in the biblical text. They claim, actually, that the Torah has two components. An oral Torah and a written Torah. The written Torah is what you have in your biblical text, the Old Testament. Right? What God gave to Moses on Sinai. And generally refers to the first five books, if you're going to be really technical about it. But that's what the information that God passed on to Moses at Sinai. Now, these rabbis also said, God told Moses some other stuff. He didn't write it down. All right? And these two need to work together. Some other stuff as to how to interpret that written Torah. And so there was this claim that there was this long-standing oral tradition that accompanied the written Torah. Well, with all this chaos and crisis of the first century, the rabbis said, we almost became extinct here. We better write this oral stuff down. All right? And that is precisely what they did. The stuff, these sayings that I'm giving to you, that I'm talking about, when the rabbis say, it comes from this oral tradition, all right? And in Judaism, you can never separate oral and written. You can't just pick one. They're a package, all right? They inform each other. So what does this oral Torah look like that these rabbis said, we need to write this down? Well, there are a couple different texts. The Mishnah, if you've heard that term. How many have heard that term, Mishnah? I'm just curious. Yeah, you probably heard it. Trying to figure out, you know, often where it fits. It is a compilation, and it can, if you get it in translation in English, which it's out there, go to Amazon.com, I guess, and you can buy the Mishnah. It's one volume, and it's basically legal code. How are Jews to live out their lives? And why did they need another legal code if they already had a written one? Well, things had changed a lot since Moses had been on Sinai. A lot of time had passed. We noticed that in our society. 150 years ago, the whole idea of traffic law would not have been there. Traffic court. I mean, we dealt with horses. So there are some of that, but we have whole categories of things that have emerged because of, you know, changes in technology and changes in, you know, things that we have access to. So this first one was the Mishnah. They realized, with this Mishnah emerging, that this Mishnah itself needed some commentary, all right? So, which is, you know, this is legal code. You can't just let it be. You need to keep reevaluating it. They worked on, then, the Talmud. The Talmud was compiled between the 3rd and 6th century. Sixth centuries. So it was a couple hundred years in the making. There are actually two large Talmudic collections, but the one that is most often referred to is the Babylonian Talmud. A lot of Jews out of that crisis in Palestine went to Babylon. Many were still there from the first exile. And that was a safer place for Jews to live and where they had some protection and where their intellectual freedoms were not stifled. So some of the most powerful and incredible literature of the Jews of this time comes out of Babylon. Right? So this Talmud. Now, I told you the Mishnah you can get in one volume. The Talmud is many, many volumes. So each page of the Mishnah is commented on. And so it keeps expanding. All right? Now, what language are these things written in? The Mishnah is almost entirely in Hebrew.
Uh-huh. Can I just ask, does the Talmud continue to grow, or is it static right now?
Technically, it could continue to grow. It hasn't. Partly because you can keep adding commentary. But they do it in other forms. And so, yeah. But technically, yeah. I guess you could continue to add to it. So, So it takes up a shelf. I have a CD-ROM because it's hard to travel with Talmud. So I have a CD-ROM that's got it all on there, which is, you know, the rabbis would probably be so jealous. You know, that I can get on an airplane with my laptop and my CD-ROM and I've got the Talmud, man. But then they'd also say, we know it a whole lot better than you do. These two are more legal in nature, although the Talmud has some stories and anecdotes, like the ones I gave you today. Along with this, there's also commentary specifically on the biblical text. That is that term that we talked about, midrash. All right? Commentary on the biblical text, making it contemporary, relevant to the situation in which people live. Right? So that is kind of the body of oral law. Now, the Midrash is not just a book or a few books. There are many collections of Midrash. All right? And if you would like further information as to where to locate some of these things, there are some very good excerpts in English and very accessible. The one that I would suggest starting with in this is called Pirkei Avot. And actually you can get this online. And not ordering, I mean, that stuff is out there. And it means Sayings of the Fathers. And it's a wonderful collection. And I have some specific editions I could recommend if you're interested. So that's kind of where we're at with this rabbinic literature. So this whole collection here, all right? But like I said, make sure that we always remember that this oral and written tradition always need to be held next to each other. You cannot take one without the other. There were some Jews within the tradition that exclusively wanted to go with this. They were considered, I guess if you're using a Christian term, heretics. Jewish term is min or minim. Others said, we just want to go with the written law. Sadducees were that group. They were not accepted as mainstream. Right? So those two things need to go together. It's a little bit complicated in terms of these sorts of things, but I think it's important to kind of get some of these sorts of issues out there. Do you have any questions about this?
If Midrash is a commentary on the text, the biblical, the scriptural text, why is it on the oral tradition and not the written tradition? Or is there a Midrash that's connected to the written tradition?
No, partly because it comments on, this is, when I say written, this simply means Bible. All right, that's all it is. That's what it is. So Midrash comments on the biblical text. That's why it's under the oral law. It is not itself the biblical text. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was more typical of our Bible versus the Bible commentaries, which we've got. You've got some.
Exactly.
We've got one of them. How many commentaries out of the Bible?
Exactly. And they can keep growing and growing, you know, and some are better than others. And some are really valuable to us. And so that's kind of what that difference is.
And then just for my clarification, I guess maybe some others, on the oral side, the rabbinic tradition would believe that all of this was communicated directly to Moses, or did some of this come about beyond Moses?
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing in terms of how it got to Moses. They do have a sense that there is a connection of rabbis. They say, you know, Moses spoke to Aaron, Aaron spoke to so-and-so, his sons, but all the way down to Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah spoke, and they do have a chain. So they do try to connect what they say here back to the tradition of Moses. But there is also a saying that says that God allowed Moses to come down from heaven. And by the way, after the first century in the Jewish tradition, there is a sense of afterlife and heaven. So Moses comes down, God allows Moses a field trip, apparently. Goes down to the yeshiva. A yeshiva simply means sitting place or Jewish school. And he sits in the back and was allowed to listen in, and there's all these great rabbinic scholars, Rabbi Akiva and Hillel and Shammai, some of these names you may have heard, and they're all saying, you know, in the name of Moses, we say, and Moses says to God, I don't don't really understand anything they're saying. And God says, don't worry, you were a lot smarter than you thought you were. So, you know, that sort of thing, interpreting Moses, Moses said these profound things that he didn't even understand at the time, you know, so it's kind of an interesting thing. But yeah, there is that tradition that you can't just say anything, that it has to be connected somehow to the tradition.
Great parallel with Islam there as well.
Right, right, definitely. You're not, you know, coming in out of any direction is not entirely justified.
Well, there's all different kinds of Jewishness today. I mean, there's Reform, there's conservatives, I mean, there's various shades and all of that. So there are, it's like Protestantism, you know, really. There's so many different.
And true, that's true. But all of the Judaisms that exist today do come out of this rabbinic Judaism. All right? That is their foundation. And basically, there are five different groupings. And I'll go over that just really quickly. And as you have questions, we can go to the text. And you can go from most traditional. I really hesitate to use the terms conservative and liberal because they just are so misused these days. Let's start with more traditional to less traditional. Most traditional would be Orthodox Jews. All right? And in that category, and I guess you could say there are Hasidic Jews, and in this most traditional, these are the Jews that you might see in cities like New York or Minneapolis, Postville, right here in Decorah, Iowa, black hats, side curls, you know, in terms of traditional garb, women with either hats or wigs, that sort of thing. They try to follow the oral law to the letter. All right, so in that grouping. Then you have modern Orthodox Jews who look like you and I, all right, so you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell on the street that they're an Orthodox Jew. Perhaps the men, if they have a small kippah or head covering. And they are Jews who try to follow the oral law to the letter, but they've updated their style of dress and have tried to adapt to modern technologies and modern society. All right. Then you move into conservative Judaism. All right. They, again, are trying to be Jews in the modern world and have given up a little bit more of following that oral law or the law, whether it's oral or written, to the T. All right. So some things they've kept, some things they haven't. And often, you know, it depends on the particular conservative community. Number four on there is you'd have probably Reform Jews. And they are less likely to follow any of the law, like dietary laws, things like that, to the T. They often, I went to a rabbinical institution for my PhD, and coming from the Lutheran tradition, I was struck by how similar Reform Jews and ELCA Lutherans are. You know, that struggling with being a person of faith in a complicated modern world. And a lot of the issues that we're facing are very similar. All right? So in that, they are, and I could say that they look more to the spirit of the law rather than the letter. That's why I see such parallels between certain groups of Protestants. And that's actually no accident, because Reform Judaism did emerge in Europe, specifically Germany, during the late 18th and 19th centuries. All right, they were very influenced by the Lutheran Church there. So that's the book. There's also another group, and I guess I can say Reconstructionist Judaism. Now that only accounts for perhaps 2% of Jews in the United States. And the United States has probably the largest Jewish community in the world, larger than Israel. Reconstructionist Jews emerged in the 1920s and are very concerned about a humanistic approach to living as a Jew in society and really play up the cultural aspect of Jews. How are you a good citizen of the world? And these are really simplifying these things. So,
If you could, what... Could you break it down? Are most conservatives, or could you break it down percentage-wise, how many of the population?
I would say most Jews in the United States today would identify with Reform Judaism, conservative to Reform, and sometimes just by default. So perhaps 70%, 70 to 80% would be in that Reform Judaism. And it's not reformed, they always want to make sure, because they're not done reforming. It's very, as I said, very similar to Lutherans. Yes, Reform Judaism. And so probably 70 plus percent of American Jews would fall into that category.
Uh-huh. Where would you place the secularized Jew of the early Zionists, especially, who started the kibbutzim in Israel? They really weren't religious at all.
You know, and that is a whole other category. Sometimes in the United States, by default, they're just put in the Reform category. But often, yeah, there is a category of secular Jews, but they're very, very hard to identify in terms of numbers. But they're and Israel is largely made up of secular Jews.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, and looking at numbers, and I look at this, it's so hard because when you call yourself a secular Jew, you're not really in any sort of census. You know, in terms of that. But there is a fairly significant number. But I think in the U.S., often just by default, they're placed in that Reform category. Also in that Reconstruction, in that fifth category, I put Reconstructionist, and they'd probably be really offended, but just because I want to just use one hand. New Age. There's a renewal movement in Judaism, and one of the centers of this would be between Denver and Colorado Springs. And there are some very popular and innovative synagogues and Jewish communities there that are looking at Judaism from another angle. All right, and that's still not very big, but it's gaining presence in terms of what they're publishing and their effect on the Jewish community. Right? And all of these Jewish groups really, you know, kind of emerge, like I said, from rabbinic Judaism. These distinguishing characteristics. Before the 17th century, there was no such thing really as this variety. All Jews were traditional. They lived in ghettos, primarily in Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and there was much less variety. With the age of the Enlightenment, Industrial Revolution, breaking out of the ghettos, that's when you start seeing more diversity again within Judaism. So really all these groupings emerge in the last 200, 250 years. Uh-huh.
Okay, now we're talking about Judaism, and you're talking about, let's talk about Jesus. Does Jesus consider himself a Jew? Or a
yes. Jesus never had any other identity but that of a Jew,
okay.
Which is kind of interesting. Jesus didn't write anything, actually, and what would Jesus have been doing in Torah school if he were to have attended? He would have probably been pretty familiar, not the Mishnah Torah, but pretty familiar with a lot of this rabbinic biblical commentary, you know, at least at his time, the stuff that was emerging. So yes, Jesus was very much of a Jew. The term Christian, if you'd asked Jesus, are you a Christian? He would have looked at you very strangely. What's that? You know, that idea of that would have, you know, starting a new movement really wasn't in his frame of reference. He saw himself as an integral part of the Jewish community.
That shows up somewhat in his visit with first visit to the temple,
mm-hmm.
where he's sitting with the elders and impressing them with what he knows.
Yeah.
Because how would a kid know this much? How did he learn all this stuff?
Well, and partly, you know, and also just in the village, his parents mm-hmm. dedicate him in the temple. He's very much a part of that venue of sorts of things, and also very much a product of his time, as I said, a turbulent century.
Yeah, would you say something about the emergence of synagogue?
Yeah, actually, you know, and that's synagogue, you said, when I say something. With the destruction of the temple, you do see a marked increase. That is where Judaism becomes centered on a rabbi and a local community. So rabbi and synagogue really become the key components of this rabbinic Judaism, because that's where you learn Torah, that's where you live together in community as the people of God, and you are led by a teacher. And rabbi simply means my teacher. It's not an equivalent position until more current times in the Reformed tradition to the Christian term pastor. Rabbi is really much more viewed as a teacher. Right.
Uh-huh. I went over there, and I forget the name of the place. It wasn't it was near Jerusalem, but anyway, the Turkish people came in there and kicked them off about 400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did that impact this significantly?
And so, not really, because there were so few Jews left. There have always been, continuously for 2,000 years, small Jewish communities, but for large parts of that, Palestine was very and this gets into modern politics, the limited population. But yeah, there have always been consistently Jewish communities, but not big ones.
So that was still like
visible. Yeah, you know, that's the thing. It didn't impact them hugely at that point. What I'd like to do now, there's a lot of things, and I hesitate to use up too much of the time, but some of this background is really significant in terms of looking at the text. Now I would like to turn to Jacob. If you have a packet, this is section number 2, and we started talking about the term yesterday, hineni, here I am, that Hebrew phrase, and how it how we look at it with respect to call. Now there's something really interesting about the character of Jacob. All right, the third of the patriarchs. We had Abraham, and we focused mostly on him, a little bit on Isaac yesterday. But as I noted, Isaac doesn't really play into that patriarchal tradition very strongly. He doesn't have a very huge role. I guess we could just say he didn't have many lines. So Jacob does, however, and is very significant for the formation of this ancient Israelite religion. Jacob's experiences a name change from Jacob to Israel. And basically, legend says, and the Hebrew language and grammar suggests that it means one who struggles with God. Right? Now, Jacob, this term hineni, appears at a couple different times in his life, and I was very interested when I examined this a little bit more closely. And you don't see any other characters in the biblical text who have this sort of progression or, you know, continuing emergence of hineni and this communication with God, or even communication with others and using this phrase. We first see it in youth, and that's on number 1. It's in, and if you have Bibles, it is Genesis 27:1. Verses up through verse 4 and 27 verses 15 through 19. And here's some really interesting uses for hineni. Can I have a volunteer to do the first passage, 27 verses 1 through 4? Anyone want to read that for me? Thank you.
When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die."
Can I have a volunteer then to read the next passage, 27:15 through 19?
All right.
Thank you.
Then Rebekah took the best garments of her elder son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on the younger son Jacob. And she put the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck, and then she handed the savory food and the bread that she had prepared to her son Jacob. So he went in to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" And Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game so that you may bless me."
Hineni's showing up twice. Here I am. Esau uses it, all right? And then we have Isaac using it in kind of an interesting way, all right? What is it that you notice about these passages, just in general? What strikes you? What questions emerge? Anything interesting here?
What is the connection with the hunting for game and bringing that in order to receive a blessing? That's an interesting concept, that the son has to bring some offering, just like they would present a grain offering or a food offering in the temple,
mm-hmm.
and then to receive this blessing. That's...
Yeah, you don't often, it doesn't seem to be a necessary pattern, you know, something that has to be done. It seems as if significant rites and ceremonies happen at the course of a meal, and they didn't have the, as we call it, the sacrificial cult surrounded by the temple, so that may have been, you know, the policy to do that sort of thing. But it's kind of like, and some people looked at that in different ways. Why did Isaac go get me my favorite food and then I'll bless you?
Yeah.
what is in that? And taking a look at Esau's response, some commentators say maybe this is just part of the way they operate in that house. Esau, go get me my burger, you know, get me my burger and beer, I'm hungry.
would men have had those cooking skills? I mean, it's not just go roast me a lamb, it's prepare me the savory food. I mean, this seems to imply some culinary skill.
Yeah, it looks like that. And there is that distinction between Jacob and Esau that people have made a lot of through history in terms of their skills and abilities and tendencies. It seems as if Esau is quite comfortable in that setting of the, you know, hunting and preparing that sort of food. Because if you are out on the hunt, it's not as if you go out in the morning and come back necessarily in the afternoon. You camp, you prepare it, that sort of thing. So in some ways, it differentiates their skills, definitely, because you don't see Jacob ever doing anything like that. But yeah, in terms of why would the father demand that of Esau? Kind of an interesting thing. There could be some positives to it, and this we've noted already. You know, if you know that text, Esau is Isaac's favorite son, all right? So there, that text has kind of let us in on that.
But that was my next question. Why does Rebekah favor Jacob? Why is it important to her that Jacob get the blessing?
Yeah, what is it with this dynamics? Take a look at the language here. He called, this is Genesis 27:1, and speaking of Isaac, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, my son. Take a look at 27:15. Rebekah took the best garments of her elder son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on her younger son Jacob. All right? So it kind of refers to that. It's like her son Jacob, his son, you know, they kind of play off of each other. It's almost like there are two teams in that house. Talk about a divided family. When I introduce these stories to my students in class, I say the original, well actually, you know, if you look at Adam and Eve, I say, but our original dysfunctional family. But yeah, there is that, there seems to be some competition there, and they seem to see different things in these sons and value different things. If Isaac is valuing Esau, and values his ability to hunt game, what might it be about Jacob that Rebekah values or sees? What might, and this, you know, you can draw on any previous on, what is it about Jacob that Rebekah might value?
His intelligence, maybe? His scholarliness?
Yeah, there is that sense. Is he, you know, in taking a look at this, they have two sons. One of them is going to take over the leadership of this great nation. Remember, God told Abraham, you shall be a great nation. Through you, you will be a blessing to all peoples. All right? You've got two guys. One, this leadership role is going to fall onto one of them. Both parents realize that. All right? Traditionally, it goes to the older son, but this is kind of an unfair situation. They were twins, after all. Mm-hmm. Esau beat Jacob by, you know, an ankle. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, to complicate the story. If you're passing on this yoke of leadership, which son could rightly hold that yoke? I've heard many commentators reflect on that. Perhaps Rebekah was saying, and what do we know about Isaac in this story?
He doesn't see well. Isn't sure which son is bringing him.
Probably doesn't hear very well. Rebekah probably knows this. She's lived with him for an awfully long time. He's not so bright anymore. Not the brightest cookie in the jar. All right, let's see, you know, kind of thinking. She's maybe wondering, is Isaac fully equipped to make this decision? Do I need to step in to take over, to get what needs to be done?
I mean, this is probably just a reiteration of what you're saying, but it's interesting that here, where women don't really have any power in the household, that she becomes sort of this countercultural, prophetic kind of voice, that she's saying, hey, Jacob, you know, he's going to do much better as the leader of all nations, you know?
And she uses the resources that are available to her in that time. I heard a discussion at the University of Chicago on this. A scholar there said, why didn't Rebekah go to Jake or to Isaac and just have it out? Confront each other. Why don't we, you know, family counseling, let's get it all out in the open. Well, you know, those are some tools that we may have available to us today. But you got to work within the context. What did she have available to her? And how was she to use those skills and those resources? So in that way, she kind of did that. And is it truly countercultural? We're starting to see a pattern here of women who are affecting the line. What did Sarah do with Ishmael and his mother Hagar? Out! She was determining some things. Abraham was perfectly happy to have Ishmael be that son. Sarah, you know, for one reason or another, decided they shouldn't be in that house once Isaac was born. You've got women making some pretty strong, you know, movements. And often, because they are behind the scenes, today we look at them and see them as manipulative or conniving or not legitimate. Hard to know. All right? So who had a, do you, yep?
My comments just doesn't show up. How did she find out? This is a private conversation to me before it's proposed at the bedside. It's not like he's screaming to his son, "Hey, go get me something to eat." So the question, you know.
Well, you think about the house. These are not,
household,
you know.
Yeah, it's not a closed house.
It's not a four-bedroom suburban
right,
home.
Right,
think
but,
about it. This is the woman who is in charge of this household. The woman knows what's going on in her house.
Yeah.
Her elderly husband is in bed. You can imagine she's not going to be that far away. This is a smart woman. She's not probably going to be. You know, she probably was doing something like this. You know, just got to make sure what he's doing, because she probably knew this would be coming up. It's no secret. You got to bless the firstborn. She'd probably been on her guard for this. She couldn't get it going until he initiated it, but once he started the ball rolling, she had to be ready to put her plan in action. My sense is that this was not something she hatched on the spur of the moment.
Premeditated,
yep.
Tribal culture usually is predicated on strong ethical moral lines, and it was crossed.
Well, in some ways, what is moral and ethical in tribal culture? I'll flip it back that way. There seems to be nothing in the text that indicated that she did the wrong thing. And, you know, we see that, as I said, as crossing that line. The text doesn't suggest that she crossed a line, which is hard for us today to process. Do values change from context to context? You know, that's kind of what we need to do, and sometimes that's alarming. But the text itself does not suggest that she crossed that line.
But wouldn't that be obvious from patriarchal, you know, father to son, firstborn inheritance at this time?
You know, but that's true, but every single time, as we're going to notice, that father to son thing is screwed up every single time in the biblical text. You see it over and over and over again. Isaac gets it, not Ishmael. You see that, you know, and again in this situation, Jacob's going to get it, not his brother. Joseph seems to carry the mantle, and he's way down the line. All right? Every single time. David, he was the runt of the crew. Every leader that God seems to pick goes against that societal expectation, which is an interesting pattern in the biblical text. And, you know, what do? God kind of, you know, changes the plans that people make.
And that's the way these powerless women had to operate. They were in more control than their husbands realized, or than the men realized at that time, by their natural superiority.
Should we call them powerless women, though? I don't know if I want to label these women as powerless.
But according to the society, yes. But
well, it's hard to know. They are never, you know, there are men and there are women in these texts, and children and servants. There are all these different stations. And I think it's a term that I look on and say, I don't want to live that life that she lived. But labeling them as powerless, I don't know. I don't know what they would have been called in their society. Women, you know? But, you know, power, I think we'd have to, I don't know that they were powerless or that they thought of themselves as powerless.
Well, they were property.
They were property, but they didn't know any other way.
Yeah, but that's from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You read, you know, if you even go back to the country's history and look at some of the writings from women, they didn't necessarily feel powerless. I mean, there's a lot of things that got accomplished well before that that were, you know, but it's a different society. When you've
right.
got an agricultural society, power is where it is. The Christian church comes out of the women running the churches for the first, 150, 200 years,
mm-hmm.
because it was in the home. That's the power source for women. That's
yeah.
where they have all the control, and they have the control.
Right.
Men don't argue with women in the household.
And maybe that's
right?
what's going on here, if the woman is in charge of that. And that's not saying there were equal rights then. I'm not by any stretch of the imagination. And there were a lot of issues. Women were property at this point. Yeah. There were a lot of issues. Sure. But what I'm trying to figure out, what is power and how did women perceive of their own identities, you know, in terms of that context?
Well, I was going to say that this is a real sort of enlightenment for me because I grew up in a Missouri Lutheran and they would teach us that these were like Satan getting in there manipulating things. And in the Christ movie, Passion of Christ, they showed the devil with his baby with the rough skin, illustrating the story that the devil had tricked that guy, and the Catholic and the Missouri Lutherans were kind of close on that.
Well, that's the conniving woman is
right.
Basically how
that's
when I heard, in seminary,
you
like
changed
I said,
my views on this anyway.
Yeah. I'm historical.
Give yourself a checkmark.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I heard this too, and in some ways, it's not like playing women against men. We're not trying to do that. We see a character in this story who sees that the leadership of the nation of Israel is going to depend on her intervention. Whether or not she saw it as good, bad, or other, she knew she needed to get involved to make some changes. She knew the characters of her sons. Esau is never called evil. He is not an evil son. He has certain talents and abilities, and a call, perhaps, that is different than what Jacob has. The mother recognizes this and says, we need to get this call thing straightened out. And she's going to do what she has to make sure that these two sons, with their different calls and abilities and talents, are put into the right positions. That's, in some ways, a parent who knows her children. All right? And I think that, and it looks like Esau gets the short end of the stick, and in some ways we'll see there's reconciliation afterwards, and Esau doesn't do too badly for himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think she does know the heart of her sons because Esau turns around and rather than accept or just be angry, he hates and plots to murder his brother. Mm-hmm. So there is something in Esau that, I mean, that's not a good leader who, when he's crossed, immediately thinks of killing the person who's crossed him.
A reactionary leader? Something like, you know, that sort of thing?
Uh-huh. You're commenting about all the different people, by the way, that don't come from the top of the line, and I may be trite, but all the people that we see that are supposedly in line are all jocks. They're all sports heroes, and they don't make good leaders. You know? I mean, the guys are going to go out and kill the meat, but don't know how to talk to anybody.
Exactly.
And so there's a, you know, God may also have this figured out that women have a better idea of who is a team player.
I'm going to take that as another point.
it's also been theorized that this is the where agricultural lifestyle comes to the fore and the hunter-gatherer lifestyle dies. And so this is the dominant, this is where agriculture becomes dominant, or
in some ways that is, but in fact, in terms of dating and that sort of thing, there have been both sort of living alongside each other, so you could look for an anthropological sort of rationale behind it in terms of, you know, competition between those two things. And in some ways it's an argument that you could make from silence, partly because we don't know one way or another. But I don't necessarily see those two ways of life in competition with each other at this point, because you still have a lot of nomadic time to come among the people of Israel. So in some ways, you know, I've heard that, but I'm not sure how much value to place on that in terms of placing one sort of lifestyle over another. Because I don't know from the text whether or not that's happening here. If a lifestyle is being chosen or if certain skills and abilities are being chosen. I'm going to take still 5 more minutes.
Well, I see this as a sort of ultimate example. The end justifies the means, and I would suggest that it's still inherently deceitful. If she felt this way, why didn't she go to the not seeing, not hearing well husband and discuss this with him and try to convince him that way? I mean, there's no attempt, and maybe she had, we don't know, I guess.
Well, the thing is, you kind of look again at the time. Was there that sort of communication? If she is indeed property, does, is that sort of open lines of communication, does that exist? Is that a channel that is open to her? If it is not, what does she have? You know, and I think that's a question that I don't know that I can answer, but I think we have to take a look at that. And basically looking at it from, you know, that, what does God think about it in this text? Does God see it as ultimately deceitful? Is Rebecca ever punished for this? Does bad Rebecca shouldn't have done that? You know, I'm curious.
That's my thing with Jacob's deceit. We have talked for so long about these conniving women who make things happen, and yet what they make happen is what God had already sanctioned.
You know, that's true. That's,
so these women actually are more in touch with the will of God than the patriarchs.
Which is, again, the unjustifying the means.
Which is God. You know, but if God is the end, I guess it's hard to argue at that point.
It's not just the unjustifying the means. If the man, if you flip the story, it's the man who's getting in the way of what God had already foreordained or had planned. And so the woman is using whatever means necessary to make sure that God...
To set that straight.
To make sure that it is God's will.
And our assumption is Esau wouldn't have been a good leader.
Chose, if God has chosen Jacob to be the leader, we don't know what kind of leader, but we do know that Esau has married foreign women. All right? Now, that's a real problem in those days. It kind of is distracting, apparently. So, take a look at this. I just want to take a look at this use of hineni in this passage. Now, hineni, after yesterday, sort of this glorified thing, here I am at your service. What do you make of Jacob and Isaac's use of hineni? Here I am. I don't know take a look first of all at some of these. And Esau's. What do you make of this use of hineni here? It kind of complicates matters. Yep.
Well, in the first, it does seem that Esau is saying, here I am.
Esau is saying it.
And, you know, what do you need, Dad?
So he, you know, it's kind of the way, at your service, I'm prepared, I'm willing to do what you need me to do.
And wouldn't he probably have been expecting this blessing coming? His dad is dying, the blessing's coming, so he would have been, you know,
at your service.
Spot.
But he probably, you know, didn't know, because look at, again, he says, he called his elder son and said to him, my son, and before he knew what the call was about, again, we always see this, the hineni comes before the content of it. Yeah, so he doesn't know. So he says, I'm at your son. Esau has this hineni of real integrity there. He doesn't know what's going on. Right. He just says, I'm at your service. All right? Now, interestingly enough, I kind of framed this as Jacob using hineni deceitfully. But does he? No! It's interesting. He never has to use that deceitfully. What does he say? Take a look at Genesis 27. So he went up, and he said, my father. And he said, and he, meaning Isaac, here I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's going on there? All right. And what do you make of Isaac's use? What does that mean? What does that turning of the tables mean?
All of a sudden, the father is recognizing the son as the leader.
Oh, yeah.
I am at your call.
I am at your call. We've got some reversal going on in that passage. Here I am. Do you think, and this is an interesting question, that at that point, Isaac truly didn't know which son was in front of him? Do you think he was that far gone?
He recognized the voice.
Or
maybe it's simply a symbolic of, I'm ready to give up my role as leader. And
I'm passing it on.
Yeah.
Possibly, because he says he named me. He heard the voice. He's maybe suspicious. He doesn't say, who are you? Here I am. He says, here I am. And then he says, who are you, my son? Yeah, that's kind of funny. What do we make of Isaac using that in terms of calling? It complicates our sense of this who's calling sort of thing. You know, with Abraham, you've got God calling, you know, first once, and then Abraham. Now you've got some interesting uses of hineni here where, you know, God seems to be working through others in this story. Yeah, I kind of wonder about that. Where are we hearing that call? Where is that coming from? And just to take a look, I'd like you to take a look at this tomorrow, because there are two more times in Jacob's life. One is in middle age, and if you know the story, Jacob has to flee. He goes to a cousin, Laban. He ends up marrying both daughters. The one he wants, he's got to wait quite a while to get, so he ends up with two wives there, and apparently some concubines, and or mistresses. And in those days, that's not such a negative thing at all. Rachel and Leah then are with him. Finally, it's time to leave their father Laban, and he's got to take off. All right, and we see again, and it's not since that time. And take a look at verse 11, Genesis 31, verse 11. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. We've got Hineni, or you know, that call in a dream this time. And an angel again, right? So we've got that response to God this time within a dream. We don't see any communication between Jacob and God in these intervening years at all. All of a sudden, we've got, you know, he's got a wife, he's got wives, he's got children, he's got livestock, he's got to make a crucial move in his life. All of his career until this point has been with his father-in-law. Now he's got to figure out where he's going, what he's going to do, because he hears, you've got to go back to the land where you're born. It's time. Well, this isn't some easy move. He's likely been there for 30 years. This isn't just a quick move. He doesn't know any other way of life. And all of a sudden he says, here I am in that dream. All right? So you see these key points. What I'd like to take you, and we'll start tomorrow since I did this little, discussion of rabbinic literature, I'd like to have you take a look at some of the questions indicated on this, and at least read these passages again and reflect on the use of Hineni in these passages indicated. All right? So if you could do that, and we'll talk about that for the first few minutes tomorrow, as then we'll move into Moses. All right? Thank you very much. Thank you.